It's with sincere pleasure that I'm introducing someone whose work on environmental education has greatly inspired me personally and the many initiatives, sustainability initiatives at UBC. These initiatives have been championed by our President, Martha Piper, and the VPs, Lauren Whitehead, John Hepburn, Brian Sullivan, Dennis Pavlich, and Terry Sumner. And I'm happy to say that many of them are here today to listen to this talk. David Orr is the chair of the Environmental Studies Program at Oberlin College in the US. Besides pioneering work in environmental literacy in higher education, he spearheaded the effort to design Oberlin's Environmental Studies Center. The New York Times referred to this as the most remarkable of a new generation of college green buildings. He's won numerous awards from prestigious organizations such as the National Wildlife Federation and Bioneers. He holds 3 honorary doctorates, is the author of 4 books and 120 articles. He serves on several boards, including the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's a frequent lecturer at Schumacher College, and he's also lectured at hundreds of colleges and universities throughout North America. And he has particularly asked me to mention that he has a new book due out in the late spring titled Design on the Edge from MIT Press. The title of his talk today is The End of Education. I think we should certainly all be very concerned about that. Let's welcome David Orr.
Frida, thank you. It's really nice to be here. If education ends soon enough, you won't have to take finals and exams and that kind of thing. It is Friday the 13th, and Freddy Krueger was missing from his cell this morning. And for me personally, I'm standing apparently roughly under where a pipe broke yesterday. So it may give a whole new meaning to the words the speaker is all wet. It's really nice to be here, and especially the topic as it is global citizenship. And the question I'm asking with all of you this morning is what kind of citizen is the modern university and the modern college? Before I get into this, I want to thank David Ng for his hospitality and Alan, Frida Pagani for all of her work on sustainability. And for all of you, this is a very exciting place. So many things have happened here relative to sustainability in higher education. It's a real honor to be here and be a small part of that. To Bill Rees, one of my real heroes in the world, and his idea of ecological footprints has really taken the world by storm. It is a shorthand way to say very profound things. To John Robinson for time spent yesterday with describing the series project, a really exciting venture and one that will be a new landmark in building. And Holly Arnson Foster, about an hour and a half ago, began my morning here with a song. And Holly, I want to thank you for that and for all of your work with the Cycle of Life. The picture on the screen can be a sunset or a dawn. And we don't know, but what I'd like to do is to think with you about the role of higher education. One of the things that all of us share in common is we've done time in colleges and universities, and some of you out there have done hard time. More of you and me perhaps should have done hard time, but we've all shared this experience of education. And yet we don't often reflect about what it is relative to the big issues of our time. So if today's talk was a painting, what I want to do for the first 15 or so slides is to sketch out the background of that painting. And then the foreground is what you and I and our colleagues and other students around the world make of these institutions of higher education. And let me start with some hard truths. We really don't know whether relative to the challenges of sustainability, kind of an awkward word to describe a profoundly important subject. But we don't know yet whether the colleges and universities now will be an asset to the transition towards sustainability or not. What we do know is that it's not uneducated people, by and large, that are doing most of the damage to the earth. It's people like you and me, armed with or soon to be armed with advanced degrees, full of our learning and knowledge and our science and so forth. We're the ones doing the damage. Now, that's not an argument for no education. It is an argument or a plea for education of a certain kind. And if education is to be an asset to this transition, this enormously important, the most important period of human history, then we know it can't be just a celebration of humans and our kind and our accomplishments. It has to be a bigger subject than that. It has to be wider, deeper. It can't just be about credit hours and research and publications. It's got to be something more. We need, in short, really the bottom line of my talk this morning is to say that we need a larger view of education. And when we arrive at that, we'll also have a larger view of ourselves. The root for the word education is to educe. It means to draw forth from us. It isn't to stuff things into us. And the question is, what is drawn forth from us, and what is the full human stature? And then finally, I want to say that as all of you know, education, what we take to be education, formal education, and real learning are not one and the same thing. And the overlap is, I think, surprisingly small sometimes. We've got roughly 30 or 40 minutes together. In that time on the earth, a number, thousands of people will die of malnutrition. 5 species will disappear on the planet. 1,500 acres will be made into desert. 18,000 tons of topsoil will be lost. 72 acres of rainforest will be gone. 970,000 tons of carbon will enter the atmosphere. The Pentagon in the United States will spend $50 million, $14,000 a second if you work it out. Now, this is part of the background. We've lived our lives, and a number of assumptions have been made as we've come up the upslope. This is a chart all of you have seen. This is simply peak oil. And we really don't know where this peak is. Some people believe that the peak was actually last year on Thanksgiving Day at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But we don't know where the peak is. But we do know that we're coming to the end of the era of cheap, portable fossil fuels. And tar sands won't save us. We know that the oil estimates or estimates of reserves are politically charged. And so estimates of reserves, oil reserves, for example, in Saudi Arabia, we have good reason to believe are inflated. But we've lived our lives coming up this upslope, and that has been a blast. That was rock and roll music. That was four-barrel carburetors and convertibles roaring down freeways. That was consumption, rapid growth, fast food places. That was the era, as Bill Catton once called it, of human exuberance. Now, here's what's about to happen. We don't know exactly when and what it'll look like, but world energy demand will continue to rise, but supply will at some point, perhaps beginning last year or 10 years from now or 15 years from now, will begin to drop. And it's the delta between that curve and this curve that is the problem. And a number of things will come undone as we reach that point. This is the second big, the second major component of this background of this painting. This is global climate change. We now release from all sources combustion of fossil fuels, agriculture, forestry, about 8.5 billion tons of carbon, give or take. But you've got to get to a world that releases, give or take, about 3 billion tons of carbon. Add one or two or whatever, but that's roughly the ratio. But here's the problem. World population now stands at about 6.4 billion. It'll rise in the lifetimes of those of you who are students to 8 to 10 billion, just rounded up to about 9 billion on average. And those ratios tell you a whole lot. You've got to disinvent fire. You've got to go from a fossil fuel-driven world to one driven by efficiency and renewables. This is a curve that all of you should recognize. This is the Keeling curve of carbon in the atmosphere. David Keeling went to Mauna Loa in 1958 and began to record carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You've all seen this. We're now at about 382 parts per million carbon dioxide, with maybe another 40, I don't know, give or take, of CO2 equivalent of other heat-trapping gases, halons, bromines, chlorofluorocarbons, and so forth. The temperature implications of this are striking. This is the IPCC's projection of 21st century temperature projections, and measured in Fahrenheit, it comes out about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit at the low estimate, and maybe about 10.4 at the upper estimate. We don't know, but somewhere in between here, all hell breaks loose. And then there was evidence January a year ago, published in Nature magazine, that in fact the IPCC, which is the largest body of scientists, as far as I know, ever assembled to study any given issue, that the IPCC had it half right. It will in fact be twice as bad and a good bit faster than they had projected. And there's some reason to believe that that's true. What we do know is that the temperature anomalies and climate anomalies generally, the hottest hots, wettest wets, driest dries, windiest wind conditions, and so forth, are now breaking out all over the world. We're setting records across the whole range of climate and weather conditions. This is the oceanic conveyor. This is the cover of an article in Nature magazine about a month ago or so, saying that the North Atlantic conveyor, which is crucial for the climate or weather stability of northern Europe, is slowing, and that's a bad sign. It's slowing because of temperature and salinity gradient changes in the North Atlantic due to climate change, the melting of ice caps in Greenland and the Antarctic in particular. But this is bad news. And in about 20 years, apparently, it's shut down about 30%. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment Report, which came out spring a year ago, says this: there is established but incomplete evidence that changes being made in ecosystems are increasing the likelihood of non-linear changes, just read surprises, in ecosystems, including accelerating, abrupt, and potentially irreversible changes with important consequences for human well-being. Now, one of the difficulties we have in the States, at least, I'm sure this is not true in Canada, but the day that this came out, the New York Times, our flagship newspaper, had this, as I recall it, about page 8, and it gave it about 6 column inches. Page 1 was the Terry Schiavo case, if you recall that. The fact that the planet is dying was a kind of a minor concern. The fact that one woman may or may not have been brain dead was hugely important. James Lovelock puts it this way: sometime during this century, the Earth system will pass a threshold beyond which it is committed to irreversible and mostly adverse change. Once we pass this threshold, set by the level of carbon dioxide in the air, of somewhere between 400 and 500 parts per million, nothing the nations of the world do will alter the outcome. We are, in a sense, like passengers on a small pleasure boat sailing quietly down the river towards the Niagara Falls, not knowing the engines are about to fail. And you take the 382, give or take, parts per million, add to that the other heat-trapping gases and CO2 equivalent units, and we're at 420, 430, no one really seems to know. It isn't global warming that faces your generation. It's planetary destabilization. Rising sea levels, more storms, more severe storms, changing diseases, drought and heat waves increasing and becoming more likely, changing ecosystems, coral bleaching and the destruction of marine ecosystems, political and economic disorder, and a death toll now that the World Health Organization estimates that about 150,000 people die each year because of climate-driven weather events. This is from Bill Reese's work. We're already short a fraction of a planet, and if everybody, as Bill has pointed out, tries to live at the North American lifestyle level, we're 3 or 4 planets short. Now, Jared Diamond, recent book, Collapse, and I would encourage all of you to read it. It's a long read, but it's also a very good book. Diamond studies societies that fail to respond to ecological disorder and some that did respond in time to it. But when they fail to respond, here are the things that explain that situation. They failed because they failed to anticipate the problem, reasoned by false analogies or whatever, but they just didn't see what was coming. Sometimes they fail to see existing problems, things that are slow trends. Our eyes pick up fast and big, not slow and long-term kinds of things. We just didn't see existing problems. And climate change and soil erosion are slow kinds of processes. Sometimes they fail when they can't solve problems that are evident because of groupthink, or what Garrett Hardin once called the tragedy of the commons. We set the rules of the game in such a way that we just can't solve problems. Sometimes they fail because things are beyond our capacity to solve them. And that happens sometimes, as Thomas Homer Dixon at the University of Toronto says, because of an ingenuity gap. We're just not smart enough. We get ourselves into complexity problems. John Platt once described what he called a crisis of crises. It's a quadratic equation. A number of things have to work out in order to get through the problem. Sometimes, as Joseph Tainter once described, the ratio of energy available to a society goes more to maintenance than into creativity, but it's the creativity that allows us to solve problems. And then finally, Diamond says, sometimes we just can't get through problems because the elites that control the society become isolated. That's not a problem in the United States, however. David didn't ask how many of you are FBI agents, but it'd be a useful question sometimes. Martin Rees, the British Astronomer Royal from Cambridge University, in a little book published in 2003, Our Final Hour, gives us, after surveying the entire landscape of potential crises and so forth, gives us no better odds to make it to the year 2100 than 50-50. Now, let me go back then, just stop just for a second. We hear all of these things. And if you're a young person looking out on the world, the issue here is, what kind of world am I coming into? And the truth of the matter is, we are in dire straits in many ways, not entirely. It is not a world without hope. But it calls us to understand how to keep hope alive on this world and how to equip you to act faithfully on hopeful dreams. Now, I want to, the next three slides, I want to detour just a little bit. Edward Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And Freud, of course, the major psychoanalyst of the 20th century, gave us a structure of the human personality that has the superego, that's our conscience, the ego, which is our consciousness, and our id, which is all that bad stuff about us. And his nephew came to the United States, went into advertising, and shaped modern advertising. He is the founder of the largest effort ever to deflect human consciousness and human intellect. And what he believed was that we had to appeal, that the people who run the society had to appeal to the id to satisfy all these strange desires down in the basement of our personalities. And if we didn't do that, disorder would break out. He's the guy that figured out how to keep the public docile by giving it lots of consumption. So when you trace the history of the consumer economy, Edward Bernays' name shows up at the very beginning of the process. He's the guy that taught auto manufacturers to sell cars by selling not a car, but sexual potency to men. And smoking for women became a sign of freedom. Cigarettes were called little torches of freedom. And he gave us this phrase, the engineering of consent. And this is a quote from him. The engineering of consent is the very essence of the democratic process. Note the implications of that. The freedoms of speech, press, petition, assembly make the engineering of consent possible. But those people whose consent was engineered had no say in the matter. This is the derogation of the destruction of democracy, the largest effort ever to deflect human intelligence and intellect away from real issues, real problems, over to a fantasy world created by other people. As a result, everybody can recognize that top logo. Everybody around the world virtually recognizes that logo. And we can recognize 1,000 or 2,000 corporate logos, it is said, but typically fewer than 10 plants and animals native to our region. The Nike swoosh, the Coke symbol, the McDonald's M. We recognize these things immediately. The largest effort ever to deflect human personality and intellect. Now, let me make a transition to education. And it is something, I think, of a miracle. Because we now live in a society where governments have not done what governments, by and large, ought to have done relative to those background conditions of climate and environment and biotic impoverishment. And industry hasn't done it, although it has stepped up perhaps more so than higher education. But if there is to be a miracle, if there is a hopeful future for you, it really does need to begin here. In many ways, it is beginning in this very place. Let me start with some principles. Ecological disorder reflects a prior disorder of thought, perception, and values. The ecological crisis is a crisis of mind, crisis of how we think. Therefore, a challenge to institutions that purport to improve minds. In every way, this is a crisis, not first and foremost of technology or economics or even politics. It is a crisis of how we think about the world. Second principle, all education, every bit of it, is environmental education. We teach people that you're part of or a part from by what we include or what we exclude and how we shape a curriculum. It's all environmental education. We teach people you are isolated and separate or you're part of this larger enterprise. Third principle, environment isn't something that's just another item on a long list. The environment ought to be the linchpin that connects lots of other issues. It is the integrating thing of all the things that every discipline and every human being shares. We all breathe the same air, drink the same water, live in the same land, suffer the same climate problems or benefit from them. We are all part of the planet. Climate and weather and biotic systems and ecology, these aren't just separate things. These are integral to everything that we do. Fourth principle, maybe there is something to Howard Gardner's view that there's a naturalist intelligence. Gardner, in an earlier book than this one, identified six or so forms of intelligence. And we know that intelligence isn't just one thing. It's many things. And all of you have different kinds of intelligence. There are people who are brilliant mathematicians but can't tie their shoes. There are people who can paint wonderful pictures and evoke all kinds of imagery and make wonderful musical performances, but they can't do things that we would otherwise think are intelligent. When Gardner went back to look at those six, he added another one and a half kinds of intelligence. And one of those is the naturalist intelligence. And what is it? He also had the idea that we ought to develop this new species virtue, species humility. Imagine that. But I think if you press the issue a little bit, ecological intelligence will look something like this. It will allow you or equip you as students and faculty and all of you in the public to begin to see patterns that connect, kind of a systems intelligence, to connect the dots that, yeah, I see that is related to this. What I drive is related to the climate conditions that we see. We'll begin to see the way feedback operates and things like leads and lags, that we can do something in the world, but it may not have an initial cause or probably initial effect, but someday it will. And begin to understand the world as systems. And then the third thing I think that we'll discover is that ecological intelligence really involves an extension of the time horizons, that we can see the longer term. And this isn't innately difficult for us. We've had anthropological evidence from many different cultures that some civilizations, when they got it right, in fact, did take long-term into consideration, even though their velocity was much slower than our own. Here is a suggestion. A good bit of what we do in higher education is simply remedial because of what happens in childhood. Richard Louv's recent book, Last Child in the Woods, is a wonderful story about how what's happened to childhood in the modern world. And in many ways, we create children who are now products of the shopping mall and television and Internet and so forth, everything but natural systems. That may be less true here than it is in Ohio, but it's certainly true. How do we get kids back in the woods again? How do we change childhood to make childhood a celebration, not of all the ain't it awful stuff, not consumerism, but how do we give children back their childhood? The United Nations says that about 250 million kids on Earth effectively have no childhood because they work as slaves for multinational corporations. But many hundreds of thousands or millions more children have deformed childhoods because they have too much consumption, too much television, too much violence, and so forth. Here's a second suggestion. The way we learn, this was originally titled pedagogy, and pedagogy is a word with a long pedigree, but it also sounds like a foot disease, so I decided just to include this as retention, but we learn in lots of different ways. When we get the environment right in higher education, we'll have lots of different ways to learn, and all of us learn in different ways. Some learn by reading, some learn by experience, but we find that what we retain, as you come down this pyramid, what you retain increases by the active involvement in projects. Every place, every course I have, everything I try to teach, I try to engage students in actually doing real things, designing real buildings, or working on real issues. But we know that when people are actively engaged, the retention and the power of learning increases. In higher education, we need to rethink how we teach based on how we learn. Here's the conventional model. This is the third suggestion, to rethink the architecture of the curriculum and what happens on college campuses. This is the kind of the standard model schematic, and every advance in learning makes us smarter and smarter, and down here somewhere is your, I don't know, great-grandparents' generation where people were ignorant and lived in utter and total misery, and you're headed up here toward a really intelligent society where people will have very small, soft fingers for pushing little tiny buttons and great big eyes, kind of like a, you know, the alien-type creature for looking at computer screens and so on, but that'll be a really intelligent society. Let's rethink that just a minute. If you rethink it, and maybe if knowledge is like a sphere or a circle, and everything that we know is inside this red circle, that's the known. And so not every advance of knowledge necessarily is a good thing. Now, this raises all kinds of complicated issues. But as research pushes the boundaries out here, what else increases? Well, the interface between the known and the unknown. And so when Thomas Midgley Jr. invented chlorofluorocarbons in the 1920s, the circle grew. Things got bigger because now we knew how to do something we didn't know how to do before. What else grew? Well, hazards. We didn't know what these things did. So knowledge created both, the advance of research created both knowledge and also ignorance at the same time. And it wasn't until the 1970s we began to suspect that chlorofluorocarbons may not be good for the world, and then we discovered in the 1980s that, in fact, they were for sure related to the destruction of the ozone layer in the atmosphere, and also tied to global warming. And so not every advance of knowledge is necessarily a good thing. Bill Joy, one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, in a wonderful article in Wired magazine in April of 2000, a long article, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. Joy began to argue that we ought to have a moratorium around things that can self-replicate. Nanotechnologies, genetic engineering, artificial intelligence, if we can create anything that will replicate without any further help from humans, we shouldn't do it. And he called for a moratorium on this. Now, two things strike me about this. One is, I don't know that this is right or wrong. It mirrors an earlier argument made by a man by the name of Robert Sinsheimer in 1978 in a journal called Daedalus, an article called The Presumptions of Science. And I don't know whether Sinsheimer was right when he said, is there or should there be forbidden knowledge? Knowledge that we're not ready to handle yet. Knowledge that we don't have the institutional capability to control. Or knowledge that we're just not smart enough. Is there good knowledge, bad knowledge? I don't know. But I'll tell you what I do know. That is an interesting question. That's the kind of question that every college, every university, when it's posed, ought to say, hey, time out. Let's have a day or a week or a month on this campus where classes are suspended and we wrestle with that issue. And the second reason for this is it's not just portentous. It is a really interesting question. This involves everything that we know. This involves philosophy, politics, economics, technology, science. It involves everything. This is both interesting and incredibly portentous. If we get these things wrong, we've had it as a species. And this is not an argument for ignorance. It's not an argument to burn books. If your argument comes back and you say, well, yes, we should ban things that can self-replicate, and Bill Joy is certainly right, then the next question is, how would you do it? How would you keep in the state's First Amendment freedoms or the freedom of inquiry? How would you keep that? And who are the book burners? We know book burning has a certain history. So these are complicated issues and complicated questions, but if they can't be raised at UBC or Oberlin or Harvard or, you know, University of Toronto, where could they be raised? They have to be raised here. And we have to raise up a generation of young people able to look down the barrel with courage and see these issues for what they are and begin to answer them. I have another suggestion. If the environment is a problem, what kind of problem is it? Maybe it's a design issue. Maybe it's not human evil or necessarily even ignorance. Maybe it's a problem of how things relate and how systems might be formed. If it's a design problem, then it becomes kind of interesting that to put 1 pound of product on a shelf, we leave 32 pounds of debris upstream at wells and mines and manufacturing establishments. 3,200 to 1. We can do better than that. Energy to food ratio. We take in the States on average 11 to 17 calories of fossil energy to put one calorie on a plate at mealtime. Security, we spend $14,000 a second. Design issue. Design as a curriculum issue. This is a book by Janine Benyus, Biomimicry. And Janine points out, for example, that spiders take dead flies and sunshine to make materials five times stronger than steel and tougher than Kevlar. That's biomimicry. What Janine is describing as biomimicry is tapping into 3.8 billion years of evolution and begin to reshape the materiality of our culture and begin to think about how that might infuse a curriculum. If nature, that 3.8 billion years of evolution, is kind of a template, what might we learn from that time? This is Wes Jackson, who's asking the same kind of question. This is an uncut prairie in Chase County, Kansas. What Wes is doing here is to try to understand how the prairie farms, how prairie ecosystems might inform how we actually engage in agriculture by mimicking natural systems. I could go on with this, but this is ecological design. Ecological design might be the core of a university-wide or college-wide commitment in all of its various forms and patterns. Here's another suggestion. In many ways, I could argue that we don't have a sustainability problem, but we do have a political problem. It's the political machinery. No one wakes up in the morning and says, hey, I want to drive a species or two into extinction today. Or I'd just like to shoot a whale, pave something over, you know? No one wakes up like this. All right, Dick Cheney. Check the people sitting beside you for FBI agents. But we find that the people who, if you look at public opinion poll data, people want a world that is sustainable, that big, cumbersome word. But the machinery that connects the public preference and public policy is broken. But then we find that, with exception of this little uptick here, by and large in the States, this is data that Linda Sachs at UCLA has generated over 20 years or so, by and large, young people, this generation, are less interested in politics than any generation before. Thomas Jefferson, if that's not an argument against democracy, and Jefferson put it this way, I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of society, but the people themselves. And if we think them not intelligent enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion, education. Now, the difficulty is education doesn't just happen at UBC. Education happens all the time. As we said, Edward Bernays' work is a form of education, highly clever, sophisticated, manipulative kind of education. But where do people get the news? What do we know about politics? Well, in the States, by and large, what we know about politics is taken from television and from radio. And you'll notice in this chart, students are increasingly dependent on electronic media forms, less so than teachers and principals of schools. And on average in the States, about 80% of what people know about the world they've gotten from television. But if that is from Fox News, an oxymoron, they don't know much. This is, I'm sorry for being U.S. Specific here, but this is when Ben Bedikian wrote his book, Media Monopoly, in 1980, there were still 50 major media outlets. You could depend on the media for some quality information. Now we're down, not just to 6 is here, but actually, as of last month, down to 5 media outlets. And that includes Fox and, of course, Disney that owns ABC News and so forth. Now, in the States, 2 things happen. The dumbing down of the American public happened in part because what came over the media, the airwaves, radio, and television, was increasingly biased. The fairness doctrine that had been in place for quite a number of years, 40-some years, was tossed out in the late 1980s because conservative or right-wing objections to it. And what the fairness doctrine required was for every station, for the license for every station, television and radio, you had to present both sides or all sides of an issue. And if you didn't and the citizens complained, then you would be held in a hearing before the FCC and you might lose your license. And so there was at least a presumption that stations needed to hold a public license to the public airwaves, needed to be fair and balanced. That was tossed out. And then the Telecommunications Act of 1996 allowed companies to own radio stations television stations and newspapers all serving the same media market. So it was, the effect was to basically put a bubble over places like the city immediately south of me that has 11 clear channel stations. You can get Rush Limbaugh virtually all the time, and when he's off, you can get Ann Coulter and other right-wing interesting folks. The result in the States is that when the World Press Organization looked at the U.S. press, they rated the United States 27th in terms of freedom of press in the world, 27th, and probably headed south from that. Another suggestion for Green Campus, and this is happening here with the Troy Building and John's Building and a number of other projects around the campus, Green Building. And for the past 10 years or so, this is the Lewis Center at Oberlin College we began to do in 1995. And what we did with this project was to engage students in a series of classes and other venues to come in and help us design the building. And their design criteria for this building was we ought to cause, or this building ought to cause to the extent feasible, no ugliness, human or ecological, somewhere else or at some later time. And if that's the standard, then you go upstream from the actual building to wells and mines and forests and manufacturing establishments where material flow starts. And if you've compromised human health and human dignity or ecological integrity, you can't say that that building is beautiful. And the same thing as you go downstream. If you've contributed to climatic change or the toxification of the world or whatever, biotic impoverishment, you can't say that that building is beautiful. But green building is beginning to happen. This is the photovoltaic array on the top of that building, the first of two, that will power that entire complex of two buildings from current sunlight. The cost of PV is dropping dramatically. The world market for it rising dramatically. Japan has emerged as the largest seller and manufacturer of photovoltaic equipment. And we installed a second large array on this site. We couldn't buy U.S. equipment, although the United States 20 years ago or even 10 years ago was a leading manufacturer. Now we had to buy from either Japan or Germany, and then there's a long waiting list. What else can you do in terms of Green Campus? This is the president of Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. Put up a 1.5 megawatt wind tower, which provides about 60% of the electricity on the campus. Across town, St. Olaf College has done the same thing, and wind power, again, growing very rapidly, the fastest growing wind energy source. A couple other comments. This is a conundrum. We purport to be learning organizations to advance learning, and yet the issue before us, all of us in higher education, is whether we ourselves can become part of learning organizations, not relative to market share, not relative to grant revenues, but relative to these large changes in the biogeochemical cycles of the Earth, the large changes in the human prospect. That was the first 15 slides of this talk. Can we begin to recalibrate what we do in education with the way the world works as a physical system? And if we do, we'll build smart buildings, but it isn't just enough to build smart buildings. We've got to become smarter organizations. We'll begin to learn relative to larger issues. It's an appropriate question to ask is, why is this important? Do I really need to know this? And what are the larger implications of it? We'll incentivize efficiencies. Frida has begun to do here on this campus. Somebody needs to be responsible. It needs to be in somebody's interest to make sure the lights are turned out. We'll encourage risk-taking. One of the things that we do sometimes is to encourage young people never to take a risk. And, of course, that's the riskiest thing of all. Take risks. Join the world. This is not a time for people who shrink back. This is a time for bold visions and people who can act on those bold visions. And then learning organizations will change the way they think about money. The most common argument against doing a green building or oftentimes sustainability projects of any kind is, well, we just can't afford it. We can't really afford not to. This is human survival. This is all hands-on deck time. And the way we think about money has got to change. When you did the Lewis Center at Oberlin College, one of the things that we did not do very well was to figure out all the collateral benefits. Analyzing all the costs is fairly easy, but if you do things right, as John Robinson knows, if you do things right, there'll be a whole stream of things come out of those projects that will be collateral benefits that you could never have anticipated at the start of the project. And then contrasting values. Let's talk about careers, and all of you, and I want to end on this note. This, again, is Linda Sachs' data, and you find that making a lot of money in life and developing a meaningful philosophy of life have diverged. And there are lots of reasons for that. And this, of course, again, is U.S. data. This may not at all be true of you Canadian students, but this is U.S. data. Part of the problem here is you've got to make a lot of money to pay off your college loans in the United States. I've got students that walk out of college the day they graduate, they owe $40,000 to some lending agency. But we can do better than that. Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, put it this way: be anything you like. Be madmen, drunks, and bastards of every shape and form, but at all cost, avoid one thing: success. Now, he wrote this for his alma mater. Columbia University Alumni Magazine did an issue on their successful graduates. And Merton wanted to stress one point, is that the success that he's talking about is success at a much bigger level, much deeper level. Be willing to take risks. Be on that side of the edge. We need people who are wildly, crazily creative. These are the challenges you face. I'm not going to read that. You know what they are. But if you turn that coin over, these are the kind of careers before you. And to be a global citizen now means to understand how you play out your life against the topography of your time. Environmental education, ecological engineering, green architecture, ecological design, urban planning, industrial ecology, sustainable agriculture, earth system science, conservation biology, business, environmental law, public service, energy technology. Take the word environment and apply that to any career or any area of interest, and you can have a better career and a better life. These are three of my students. I'm going to close on these last three slides. This is Josh, Naomi, and Ben. They graduated a couple years ago, and they came into my office before they graduated, and they wanted to know what they could do to improve the downtown of Oberlin. It's in the crosshairs of Walmart, a small merchandising outfit in the United States, growing at the rate of 50 million square feet of new store space per year. And I said, well, I don't know what to do. I mean, you're talking to people who are 20 years or 21 years of age at that time. I said, what do you do to make the world a better place? They really wanted to do it. So finally they came up with the idea of building a building. It evolved or morphed into a $17 million building project. And they stuck with it. These are poor kids. Naomi, you can tell from the picture, is kind of a formidable woman, and she was in charge of raising a lot of the money for the project. And one of the things I'm involved with from time to time is giving money away. And so she called me and said she wanted to talk about fundraising. I said, well, come on over. So she did, knock on the door a few minutes later, and she came in. She said, the conversation started this way. She said, my uncle Neil just got out of jail. I said, well, Naomi, that's good news. She nodded. Why was he in jail? Well, he killed a man. Now she had my attention. Remember, this is a fundraising conversation. I said, well, she had my curiosity up. I said, well, why did he kill a man? Well, he's a hitman for the mafia. I reached back and I pulled my wallet out so fast. Said, Naomi, there are credit cards in there. There's a little bit of cash. I can get more. They raised $17 million. These are kids now 24, 25 years of age. They've launched a $17 million project that will anchor the economy of this downtown. These are kids who refused to be just kids. Wait until they were 50, 55, at the point of their first heart attack or stroke and being carried out feet first, they began to act. Now it's all hands on deck time. If you can dream, you can do it. Do it. Get involved. See life as, this is the time for you all to step up to the plate. All of you young people, take your dreams and your ideals and write your autobiography on the topography of this time in a way that involves you in these big issues. Albert Einstein put it this way. A human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He or she experiences himself or herself, his thoughts, her thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his or her consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and our affection for a few persons nearest us. And this is the part I like. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion, to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Elder Leopold, author of Sand County Almanac, and that's where he wrote Sand County Almanac, the shack in Baraboo, Wisconsin. A land ethic, he wrote, changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. What's the end of education? Well, in the end, the only thing one can say is at the end of education is to teach us and equip us to be citizens in the larger community of life. Trustees for life yet to come, of all kinds. To teach us that things really are connected in ways that we'll never fully fathom. That we live in a mystery at the edge of a large sea that we'll never fully understand. That violence, domestic violence, international violence, in all of its forms, violence against nature, will always be self-defeating. To teach us that whole, and health, and holy, and healing are inseparable. They are one. And to teach us that kindness and charity and foresight matter. And that's the end of education.
Thank you, Dr. Orr, for that very, very, very interesting and urgent talk as well. At this point in time, we actually have time for questions. We do have two mics positioned in front of us, and I'm sure Dr. Orr would be happy to answer a few questions, as well as apparently UBCO, there's a room over there as well. So how about we'll see if there's any questions. I think we have a hand over here. You'd have to shout it out.
Don't leave, you're on TV.
FBI? Oh, now I'm on video archive.
Would you repeat the last that I'm getting interference over here to the right? Are there administrators here? Can you pay attention to him? Your name is? I think you're, and your name is?
Jordan.
Jordan, thank you for the question. Great question. Well, you know, two different issues. One is, how do they pay attention to you? And I'll take you in the large sense of students. And I think that's important. And a good bit of that is how do you break down systems of hierarchy and create channels of communication? That's the issue of a learning organization. When Peter Senge wrote his book, The Fifth Discipline, what he was trying to describe was how do organizations become learning organizations? You basically change who has lunch with whom. Somebody ought to have lunch with you. Now, the second issue raised is a campus farm. You know, we're at the end of the, about three slides into this talk, that peak oil. Our food system works okay as long as you can move heavy things long distances. And that means cheap, portable fossil fuels. But we're coming to the end of that era. So one argument for a campus farm is to begin to restore and resuscitate the skills of soil management and agriculture that have been lost in an era of agribusiness. And then there's something else about that. You know, a campus farm is just a fun thing to do. Now, I'm Presbyterian, so I don't think, or I was raised Presbyterian, so I don't think you really ought to have fun in education. Life ought to be miserable. Education really ought to be painful. I said to a group of students yesterday, the old quip about to be Presbyterian is to lie awake at night, fearing that somebody somewhere is having a good time. So a campus farm, it may be a necessity when food gets short and gets scarce. We may have to relearn things that we've forgotten. And then if you do a farm, I said yesterday to the group, make it a celebration. Make it the kind of place that is beautiful, lovely. Everybody's got to get to the farm. And there are places like this. So if there are administrators, Jordan will meet you right at the back outside the main door. And Jordan, thanks for the question. That was a good question. Thank you for that.
Thanks a lot for coming, Dr. Orr. It's funny because I have the exact same question as what Jordan had, and I had kind of planned a little preface to that, so I'll skip the question because it's already been raised, but my preface was that apparently there are a lot of administrators here. I don't recognize you. I don't know what you look like because this place is a really big place, but if you are here, I really do appreciate that you've come and listened to Dr. Orr. And I've been to lots of talks like this where someone really brilliant comes and talks and gives us great ideas, and politicians are there and they hear it and then who knows what they do with it. But I really, really plead that you take this to heart and use this when you're applying new plans for this university. I've been here for 2.5 years and I've seen nothing but buildings go up and trees come down, and I'm pretty flabbergasted at the poor planning. I won't say poor, but I really hope that this kind of has some element of change in our campus. So thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for presenting this outlook of positive changes that we as students and we as an institution can make. I do have a question, though. As young people, a lot of us have a lot of really neat ideas, and we're trying to network with people in different professions. We're trying to reach out and look into different funding avenues, but a lot of the times it comes down to how do we get funding? And you started to touch on this and kind of joking a bit about how some of your students raise some money. But when you're wanting to make big global changes and we're wanting to have a whole perception shift, where do we start? How do we really drive our projects forward?
Willie Sutton, the famous bank robber, said he robbed banks because that's where the money was. You know, the issue, it's a great question. Thank you for asking that. One of the things I'm seeing is that young people, I'm going to talk as much to the faculty and administrators here as to you. You raise money from where it is. It's a little bit different here in Canada than it is in the States. But first, have a dream. Bring other people into the dream. Develop a plan and execute the plan. Money flows to dreams that are competently stated, well executed. It's just an iron law of the universe. I'm sure if I read the book of Genesis, I know it's there somewhere. But have a dream. You know, Jordan wants a farm. Don't take the easy way out. And when somebody says, well, you know, that's really a dumb idea, and we can't do that here, and it was tried once before, it didn't work, don't take that as an excuse. The students of which I'm most proud are young people who in their early 20s, sometimes before, said, I want to do something, and I'm going to be smart enough to figure out how to do it well. I'm going to bring other people in. I'm going to make an idea that's win-win, across the board. Everybody's going to love this idea, and then just stayed with it. Now, for you administrators, I'm not going to ask you to stand up. But probably should. If, you know, our, and faculty, part of our job, is it your name is?
It's Amber.
Amber. Part of our job is to, again, education, is to make sure the Jordans and the Ambers can fulfill their dreams. And that starts now. That doesn't mean just equip them with 4 years of education or a graduate degree and then ship them out into the world. I think it means beginning to open doors for them now. This, I think, if I take my first 15 slides seriously, and I do, this is all hands-on-deck time, a nautical way to say this. This is time that we need to engage the energies and dreams of everybody. If Martin Rees is right, we've got 94 years to work ourselves out, to begin to deal with problems that have been accumulating for quite some time and reaching crisis proportions. And they are solvable problems. There's not a thing on that list of what's wrong with the world that we can't fix. We are not fated to end with a whimper and a bang. But if we have a positive future, it is because we will help the Ambers and the Jordans of this world fulfill their dreams. And so part of this is beginning to open doors and make things happen and make connections and get involved with kinds of things. And if you want to get involved in building, John Robinson's building, for example, what we did in the Oberlin building was to get students involved. 250 students got involved in the design and planning of that project. Now, I'm not answering your question. I'm just stumbling around here to try to think of something smart to say about where you raise money. Just have a dream. And then shop that dream around, and you'll find it. Money will find you, more likely. But thanks for that question.
Dr. Orr, there's a question from Kelowna. Yeah.
There's a question from Kelowna.
Go ahead.
We're up in UBC Okanagan, and my name's Michael Ross. And by good fortune, we actually have a student who's a middle school student today. His name is K.J. Hansen. He has a question for you, Dr. Orr.
Hi. Dr. Orr, marvelous speech, by the way. I was just wondering, what has inspired you to actually communicate to the world and try to change the way that education is and the environment?
What inspires you?
Yeah.
I can't. Are you up there somewhere? I can't see. Anyway, thanks for the question. Next question. I had a parent once come to me at Oberlin and say she just really appreciated what I was doing to save the world and whatnot. And I had a laugh. I'm not saving the world. And I suspect that all of you faculty and all of you students who are involved, as I am, and on various kinds of issues, do it partly because it's just fun to do it. And what else are you going to do? If I wasn't a teacher or a writer, wasn't involved in ecological design projects and in some philanthropy, I don't know what I would do. And in the movement towards sustainability, it's not a word I particularly like. Bill McDonough once said, by the way, the word sustainability is an awkward word. If you ask somebody, how's your relationship with your wife or partner or whatever, and you say, well, it's sustainable. It's so I'm not quite happy with the word, but the people in this movement are great people. And I think that this is the work of our generation that has to be done now. What Thomas Berry, the wonderful Catholic writer, describes as the great work of this generation is to begin to recalibrate civilization of how we provision ourselves with food, energy, water, materials, healthcare, livelihood, entertainment, with the way the world works as a physical system. This is the great work. Join it. Be part of it. There's nothing else to do. If you want to make money like Ray Anderson is making money as a business person, beginning to develop a closed-loop business powered by current sunlight releasing no-waste product. There's nothing else to do. So the short answer is it's just fun work. A little bit longer answer is say it's fun and it's necessary. There's no other game in town. Whatever you do, you've got to be part of this. This is the transition in human affairs. But thanks for the question. That was a very good question. Thanks.
David, I'm wondering if you might be able to, for the administrators and for everybody here, talk about some specific sort of changes that might occur with the university process. And specifically, problems that I see are the fact that business students don't really understand ecology. Ecology students have very little understanding of economics. And for myself right now, as a new PhD student, a pressure to leap in and choose a project, any project that's doable, and turn through it, produce a bunch of papers that, a limited number of people will read and get on out. So I'm just wondering what specific sort of changes you might advocate.
And your name is?
Simone.
Simone? I ride in a town like the Lone Ranger. Got here 24 hours ago. And I'm going to give you some advice, but I'm going to ride out of town tomorrow, and you have to live with it. I don't know UBC, and so it'd be presumptive to say exactly what ought to happen specifically here. So I have to talk generically. Reminds me of a conversation once, a seance with a business that wanted to become a sustainable business. It's a major U.S. corporation, one of the Fortune 500, and the corporate executive, midway through this conversation, talking about his business, said, "You know what the problem with this company is?" And there was this long pause in the room, and you could see all his underlings getting ready to write these words down, because this was going to be really important. You know, don't make enough money, or have executive bathrooms, or whatever it was. And he said something that really stuck with me. He said, "What's wrong with this company is that we suffer from a deficit of joy." He took a spiritual word, joy, combined it with an economic word, deficit, to say he wasn't having any fun. And it strikes me that a good bit of what happens in higher education, and I do not know if this is true here, but a good bit of what happens in higher education is a reflection of a deficit of joy. We are hag-ridden by schedules and by all sorts of bureaucratic routines and meetings and so forth. And the joy has disappeared. Maybe that's endemic to large organizations, but I doubt it. I think it's the way we have structured large organizations. And if we are to make corporations or colleges or universities or whatever, or the Defense Department, whatever, really effective on issues of sustainability, and then your part of that is how you experience that as a PhD student in the program. The first thing is this larger ambience. Make UBC a fun place to be. It can't be a party school. I'm sure you don't party here, but we can take a lot of the heat off ourselves. It seems to me when Peter Senge, in writing about learning organizations, probes this issue, he also talks about a level of honest discourse between people, honest conversations about why you did this, and to allow people to be risk takers without penalty. Allow a student to say, "Hey, look, that is really meaningless. And the idea of writing an unread paper in an unknown journal doesn't strike me as a particularly good way to spend my, you know, 70 years on this planet." That's an honest sort of discussion. But I think that Senge is describing an organization, organizations that move to higher levels of performance because they encourage honest discourse and don't penalize risk-taking and honesty. Now, that's kind of a preachy answer to a very good question, but I think that there's reason to begin to look at how organizations work and how they might work much, much better, and to recalibrate the organization again with the way the world works as a physical system. And there's some parts of anything that happens at UBC or Oberlin College that just aren't going to be fun to do. There are a lot of routine chores that have to happen. But thanks for the question, and good luck to you in your PhD.
Hello, Dr. Orr. I enjoyed your talk. In your talk, when you talked about we share the same air, we share the same water, we, are, of course, have to coexist on this earth, I could not but help remember a young American president, right, who said that at Rice University, you know, John Kennedy. And, of course, a few weeks after that, he was with us no more. But a legacy of his actually lived on, which is the space race to the moon. And to some degree, that changed the body politic in Washington. My question is, do you think in this day and age that that model could be applied once again in the area of environmental science and environmental thinking to help change the body politic in Washington? And the other part of my question is, you know, do we not owe it to John Kennedy to remember that part of his legacy and kind of use that to help people think beyond our limited means? Because I will tell you, the one thing that changed the way we think was the picture that Apollo 8 took of the Earth when it was in orbit around the moon. Thanks, Doctor.
Well, great question. This gets me into politics. The last book I wrote was called The Last Refuge, and it's about American politics. And American politics, as some of you may have gathered, is broken. And I think it's broken for lots of reasons, but one of the reasons is, and your question invites a response here, we tend to see the world in the States, and this I think is true here as far as I can infer, divided between left and right, liberal versus conservative. And I think that is a bunch of hogwash. I think that is a very self-serving way to define political landscapes and political opinions. If I was to poll all of you here, some of you would be conservative on some issues, liberal on other issues, confused on still other issues, and we are a hodgepodge of views and viewpoints that move as we mature and grow older through time, change. And yet we're still told that we're liberal versus conservative. And yet on the issue of sustainability, could we make the issue of sustainability, for example, kind of the equivalent of what Kennedy did with the space race, as you're defining it? Why not? Why not in the United States and Canada say that, look, our goal is to power these societies by current sunlight, not ancient sunlight as tar sands or coal or oil. And we want to do this within 20 years. The technology is there. The energy is here in this room. There is know-how in this room, the engineering departments and economics departments and business schools, if that was a choice given to us. But we suffer right now in the States a vacuum of leadership. That may not be quite the right way to say it, because we're being led the wrong way. There's leadership, all right. It's just taking us where we really don't want to go. But could we begin to harness that? And is that a liberal idea? No. Is it a conservative idea? No. And the one thing that you find out when you begin to look at the origins of liberalism and conservatism, the origins of the conservative worldview traced back to Edmund Burke, the founder of modern conservatism, a wonderful book called The Reflections on the Revolution in France, written in 1790. And in that book, Burke described the current generation, us, as being trustees, midway between a distant past and a distant future. Our job was to pass on that, what he called an entailed inheritance of laws, institutions, and customs from the past to the future. And add one thing that Burke could not have fully appreciated, and that is that entailed inheritance rests on ecological conditions, clean air, clean water, climate stability, ecological resilience, and so forth, that are being undermined. If Burke had known that, would Burke have said, yes, we need to pass on those things, but also the ecological requisites on which all of those depend? Sure. The origin of modern liberalism is often said to be Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson himself was a guy who was in debt virtually all the time. And Jefferson had this wonderful line where he describes how no generation has the right to impose its debt on future generations. And if you take Jefferson's view and make that ecological and Burke's view, you see a convergence of left and right around this idea that we have no right to destroy the conditions that our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will need for subsistence, that no generation has the right to alter the biogeochemical cycles of the earth or impair the stability and integrity and beauty of biotic systems, the consequences of which will always fall as a kind of remote tyranny on future generations. And tyranny that Jefferson referred to as being remote used to be remote in space. Now it's remote in time. It's a tyranny that our choices are imposing on future generations. That's not liberal. That's not conservative. That's an idea that both can meet and join with. And so this idea is, and it's a powerful question you've asked, because it asks us, what is the defining mission for humankind at this point in time? And Thomas Berry's answer was, the great work of humanity now has to be to pass on civilization intact on a habitable and beautiful planet. That's not an option. That is obligatory. But to do that requires a vision. And our political institutions have by and large failed to do that. That vision needs to start right here and needs to be furthered here and on my campus and other campuses. Thanks for that question.
Hi, David. My name's Philip Baer. I'm part of the Vancouver Area Relocalization Network, and we're busy here trying to encourage people to do things locally, find local energy solutions, find local food growing solutions, and maybe even eat all their food from a 100-mile radius of Vancouver. One of the things that we're having difficulty with is overcoming, when we think about creating community, the challenges as North Americans of dropping barriers and learning how to share with one another. In your experience, are there things that catalyze, that help people to come together and drop those barriers and make it easier for us to do our work?
Ways to share across cultures, you mean?
Share our vehicles, share our heating systems, share our gardens, share our ideas.
Well, that's a great question. The world that Edward Bernays bequeathed to us was a world in which Every one of us owned our own lawnmowers, washing machines, dryers, computers, cars. It was a world where the word I predominated. And there is a sea change that will be required, I think, of Western-style consumer economies to become sharing economies. And the consumptive world, Bernays' idea, which has been taken over because it's enormously profitable, obviously. You can sell lots of things to people if everyone has to own one of a particular kind of thing. But it's also a world of increasing loneliness. And I'm not sure how to answer your question except to say that that is a sea change. That's a paradigm shift, the likes of which we haven't seen. One anecdote. A film recently done on the Great Depression. People film described this as this, in a way, wonderful time of our life. You know, we only had an orange for Christmas present, but we shared and we did things together. And we sat around in the parlor at night and we sang songs and so, but we didn't have anything. It was wonderful. And then when asked about what kind of world they wanted for the children, oh, I'd never want my children to go through that. We're schizophrenic. We recall the times when we came together around sharing and participating in various kinds of things and working together as wonderful times. But then we don't want our children to share the same thing or to have that same experience. And this is part of a paradigm shift, a value shift in this culture that will be very difficult for us. But one I think that we'll find, if we can make it, is a wonderful shift to connect us to all kinds of people and give us a sense of belonging again. But that's a great question. Let me just leave it as a question for you. Yes?
Actually, hang on a second. We're starting to run out of time. I just wanted to ask Kelowna. Hi, Kelowna. Is there anybody in Kelowna that wanted to ask a question?
I think we've asked our questions, all the folks who wanted to. Thanks.
Okay. We've got time for one more question over here. But what I'll say is that David will be available for a book signing right after this question period in the rotunda. But we'll do the last question.
Last question, no pressure, right?
Yeah, don't blow this. This has got to be really good. Yeah, preferably
again,
a yes or no kind of
no
thing.
Pressure. Cool. Awesome. Funnily enough, actually, my question kind of dovetails on the last one, but it's not actually the same question, but involves sharing. I think the last question was about, in our consumptive economy, how do we share our resources and what we've got with each other instead of fostering this idea that everyone has to have their own lawnmower? And sharing, and what's more important to me specifically is sharing and how do we organize? And you spoke specifically of those are the times that we remember when we got together, when we stood up for what we believed in, and when we made change, and how awesome that felt. But I think we're also facing another paradox, and as someone who works for the student union here at UBC, I'm also in that paradox where we're trying to get in touch with our students, and the paradox is getting in touch, because we don't actually touch anymore. We don't touch students, we don't actually talk one-on-one with students. In our society today, with the pace of technology, we actually use MSN, and we use blogs, and we use emails. And yeah, we still use telephones, that happens, but rarely. And so because of the way our society has progressed and because of the progress of technology, it's becoming harder to organize because we don't actually get in touch anymore. We provide information, but we don't, again, get in touch. So I was wondering, in this society that we've built with the technology that we have, which is great and at the same time putting us farther apart, what are strategies that you've seen that work to actually be able to get in touch?
Hey, that was to be a yes or no question. You know, I take my students down. One of the things that we suffer, I think, in a world of information overload is an impoverishment of experience. And that's part of what you're describing. You're describing one part, a critical part, the lack of touching, both tactile and a real kind of communication, face-to-face, across a cup of coffee or beer or whatever. I take my students down every year in the spring. I do a class on sustainable agriculture, and I take them to an Amish farm. David Klein is a good friend of mine. He's an old order Amish farmer. They still use horses, and they travel around by buggies, and the farm size is on average of maybe 100, 120 acres and so forth. It's not nirvana. It's not a perfect culture. But the Amish will make decisions about various kind of technologies based on its effect on touching or on community. And so they will have individual hay balers, because hay is, of course, rain sensitive. You've got to get it out of the field and you can't wait. But they don't have grain combines, because getting in grain is a community enterprise. And that's a big party that they have. And so they judge technologies, whether it's a cell phone or whatever it might be, based on its effect on community. What an incredibly smart thing to do. They actually stop and think about these prosthetic devices that we would otherwise call technology. And my students typically leave Klein's Farm, and they'll say things like, wow, best day I've ever had at Oberlin. Or, that is the sanest man I've ever talked to. He operates a very busy farm. He's got 35 or 40 dairy cows, and, you know, when you're farming with horses, it's a busy kind of thing, but he never appears to be hurried. So, coming out of this, the clock speed issue is part of what you're describing. The clock speed of contemporary civilization is now incredibly fast. But the clock speed internal to everyone in this room is a clock speed that was set 50 or 100,000 years ago. We were programmed basically to tell each other stories around campfires. That's our internal programming. And we're about the same as Neanderthal folks were. Matter of fact, you may have known some Neanderthal people. But that was a joke. But our clock speed is still that of 50 or 100 or 200,000 years ago, but our technology now is this kind of staccato technology, and it's the disharmony between the two. What do you do about it? Well, what's being done about it is things like the slow food movement, having slow meals. Now, I don't know what it's like here, but in the States, that's a revolution. Getting people actually to sit down as families and talk to each other over well-prepared meals made out of locally produced and wonderfully grown food. Wouldn't that be interesting? And just to slow the pace of things down, bicycling, walking instead of driving, slow foods, the garden project, just slow things down. We give such a premium to doing things very fast, we call that efficient. And the word efficient, of course, is oftentimes the least efficient thing that we can do. But that, again, that's a big question, a great question. Thanks for asking that. Again, no definitive answer, though.
Thank you.